I'm Doug Wilson. I'm an archaeologist at the Vancouver National Historic Reserve, and I'm an associate professor at Portland State University.
Okay, well, whoever that is walking around, it's done walking around your lantern area. Go ahead.
I'm Doug Wilson, archaeologist for the Vancouver National Historic Reserve, and I'm an associate professor at Portland State University.
So can you tell me why Fort Vancouver was built? Why here and who built it?
Fort Vancouver was established in 1825, actually up on the ridge above us, and was established by the Hudson's Bay Company, and they were interested in beaver trapping, and basically this was their headquarters and supply depot, and provided a kind of a central place for all the beaver pelts and other pelts that they were gathering to be collected and stored and then shipped off to England.
Okay, and how are Hawaiians involved in the history of Fort Vancouver?
Well, Hawaiians were used as labor primarily, and early on they were already Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest when the Hudson's Bay Company got here. But they brought in relatively large numbers of Native Hawaiians to work in agricultural fields, to work in, there was a lumber mill here, as well as working as boatmen. So there was actually a large Hawaiian community here, and so many that in the 1850s they identified the village out to the west of us as Kanaka Village. Kanaka is a Polynesian term for Native Hawaiian.
And why did Hawaiians get hired for this?
The Native Hawaiians were hired because there's kind of a labor shortage in the Pacific Northwest. Plus, they were not afraid of heights generally, and were excellent on some of the sailing ships. So they were often hired for the fleets that were going up and down the coast, as well as the whaling fleets, and were very valuable, useful workers.
Can you talk about how Fort Vancouver was important to the relationship between America and Britain at the time, or how it sort of displayed that relationship?
Yeah, when Fort Vancouver was here, this was basically disputed territory, and the United States and Great Britain had come to an agreement that they would not determine who was owned, actually owned the land, and for about 20 years. And so when Hudson's Bay Company was here, this was kind of a no man's land, although they really controlled it because they were the largest company. And most of the Euro-American people that were here were working for the company or acting on behalf of the company.
And what happened to Fort Vancouver? We'll get to descriptions of what people did and stuff, but what happened to Fort Vancouver? When did it stop doing what it was doing?
Well, this particular fort was moved from off the bluff down here in 1829 and really became the core of Hudson's Bay Company operations in the Pacific Northwest. And it went all the way to 1860, was actually 11 years after the boundary between the United States and Great Britain had been determined. And they stayed here because they could make so much money off of the retail trade. They were actually selling things to the Americans and settlers coming over the Oregon Trail. So they stayed all the way to 1860. By then, the tariffs, the U.S. tariffs were kind of putting them out of business. Plus, there were a lot of other stores being developed then.
So, what was it like to be a Kanaka villager? Sort of explain what Kanaka Village was and what their daily life was like.
Really, the heart of the community here was the Hudson's Bay Company Village, which was about 200 yards to the west of us. And there were about 50 to 60 houses have been reported, and probably upwards of 600 to 1,000 people when the brigades would come in and really swell the population. But it was the largest settlement between San Francisco and Sitka, Alaska in the 1830s and 1840s, and really was an amazing multicultural settlement. There were people from all over the world, Europeans, obviously, French Canadians, Iroquois Indians from back east, Cree, all the diversity of Pacific Northwest Native American tribes either worked for or married into people that worked for the company. And then there were Native Hawaiians. And Native Hawaiians were a fairly large proportion of the population of the village and were an important element of that multicultural village.
So what did they do every day?
A variety of things. In most of the Hudson's Bay Company, the people were oriented to, you know, trading for furs and getting furs. But here at Fort Vancouver, it was a little different. They were very interested in growing agricultural products so that they could support the 30 or 40 subsidiary posts in the Pacific Northwest. Plus, they were trading agricultural goods to the Russians in Alaska and to Hawaii and to the Mexican California. In addition, they had a bunch of different, they really expanded their what they were doing here. They had a lumber mill just up the river that did many thousand of board feet of timber that was exported out. And Native Hawaiians were a big part of running that lumber mill, really the first lumber mill in the Pacific Northwest. There was also a grist mill. There was a boat works down by the river and a salmon packing facility.
Can you say that again, sorry?
There was a salmon packing facility, which they called the salmon store. And there they were catching fish or purchasing fish from Native Americans and basically pickling it and shipping it off various places, especially to Hawaii. And it's an interesting connection between Lomi Lomi salmon, a traditional Native Hawaiian dish, and the salmon that they were catching from the Columbia and pickling and shipping off. Is probably a direct connection between those two.
So you mentioned that, a lot of other people's mentioned that too, everyone finds that really interesting. You've mentioned that it moved, the location of Fort Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe you could talk about what the location was and then what the location is right now, like exactly where we are.
When the Hudson's Bay Company first got here, they established their fort up on the bluffs. When the Hudson's Bay Company first got here, they established their fort on the bluffs above us near where the School for the Blind is. And they did that because they weren't sure if the local tribes were going to be friendly to them, but also because they didn't know if this terrace down where we're at now was flood-free or if it flooded every year. After about 4 years, they made this their headquarters for the entire region, and they moved it down to the plain here. It's called Fort Plain. It was a large prairie area, and it was ideal for agriculture. It was close to the river, which was their transportation corridor, and this really became the heart of culture in the Pacific Northwest for the next 20 years.
I remember last time we were talking and you were saying what, and I know it was before Fort Vancouver was built, but what Lewis and Clark found when they came here and how Indians had already had some goods and then how they liked this area and mentioned it. Lewis and Clark is gold, you know, so you don't know. I'm just kidding. No, that was, if you could explain that again, that's really interesting.
So when Lewis and Clark floated down the Columbia River, they passed obviously right by here. In fact, we have some accounts that they got out and walked around on the prairie area that was here. But when they got here, this was one of the highest density populations of Native Americans in the entire North America. And for, you know, probably thousands of years, Native Americans had come to the Portland-Vancouver Basin and traded for fish or intermarried or interacted with one another seasonally when the salmon was running. And it was a very important area where different cultures would come and trade and discuss things and interact. And so in a sense, you know, the sorts of things that the Hudson's Bay Company was doing at Fort Vancouver was being done here amongst the Native Americans for thousands of years before.
So what were the relations between Hawaiians and the people they worked for and the Native Americans, I guess, among the three groups?
As far as we know, the different groups really got along fairly well. The people in the multicultural village were relatively living in relative harmony. Obviously, there were some racism, certainly amongst the American settlers towards the Native Hawaiian people. And we have a couple of accounts from the quartermaster who kind of cast aspersions on the Kanaka house that was right next to his house. But certainly in general, I think when the Hudson's Bay Company was here, the different races and ethnicities really kind of got along. And we know that when Hudson's Bay Company left, a big population of Native Hawaiians went north to Canada, but also some stayed here and actually intermarried with Native American groups. And in many of the reservations around here, you can, and amongst the Native American groups, you can find people with Hawaiian ancestry.
Okay. I mean, and if I ask a question that you think I've asked before or whatever, it might be that I'm trying to get a different sort of way of saying it. Or what have you done in your capacity as archaeologist, to the Kanaka Village site, or what have people done? And
what have they seen? Okay. Hi guys, give us a bow.
Okay. Yes, so if you could explain anything you found and what you did.
So archaeologists have been looking at Kanaka Village for many years. Probably the first archaeologist that was here, Lewis Kaywood, did some excavations in the pond area, which is the pond was directly associated with the village area, and looked at some of the artifacts there. The biggest excavation was done in the 1960s by a group out of Bryn Mawr, and uncovered four different house sites. In the last few years, we've been doing an additional survey out there and have uncovered probably another five house sites and done some fairly significant excavations at one of them, and then re-examined the three of the four that they had looked at before, and we're studying the types of artifacts that the people in the village were using as tools or breaking their pottery and their glassware and things of that sort, and gathering some of the bones from the foods that they were eating, both fish and wild foods, as well as domesticated animals. And through that, we're hoping to get a better idea of who these people were and what they were doing and how they were living in the village.
Can you talk about the reconstruction of Fort Vancouver and what it's trying to do?
Yeah, since the 1960s, the National Park Service has been reconstructing Fort Vancouver. And of course, they started in the stockade area. But it's important to note that the stockade areas where the kind of the chief factor, John McLaughlin, lived, and the gentlemen of the company and their families, but really the heart of the site was out in the village. And so some of our more recent efforts have been geared to trying to begin to reconstruct some of the elements of the village so that we really have both sides of the story, where the elites and where all the trading activity went and where they were storing the furs inside the palisaded fort, but also this multicultural village out to the west of it, which was such an important part of the community.
Can you talk about how Fort Vancouver is still a crossroads, what it is now?
Sure. Fort Vancouver is a major transportation location. So we have a national park here in a major urban area. And just to the south of us, major railroad line, and there's a major state highway. Directly to the west of us is the interstate highway, and then we're in the middle of Vancouver, Washington, which right now is the fourth largest city in Washington, and is probably well on its way to being third and second as the population here grows. And there's an aircraft now. So.
Because you're also in the flight
path. Right, we're the flight path.
So why did Hawaiians go north with Fort Vancouver? Or no, why did Hawaiians go north with Hudson's Bay Company when they moved from Fort Vancouver?
So when Fort Vancouver stopped its operations here, there were still quite a few Native Hawaiians living in the village. Some of them we know stayed in the vicinity, but quite a few went with the company up to Victoria, Fort Victoria then. And probably the main reason for doing that is that's where the jobs were. So they were following their company. It was a kind of a thing of, well, you can go with the company or you can lose your job.
Have you had any contact with descendants of Hawaiians who worked for Hudson's Bay Company, who worked here at Fort Vancouver, or descendants of anyone who worked here at Fort Vancouver?
Yeah, we periodically have people that come in and say that, you know, my descendants worked at Fort Vancouver, and sometimes they're European descent, sometimes they're Native American descent, and sometimes they are very proud to say that they were Native Hawaiian.
Do they ever participate in activities, or do you have any sort of...
We always try to encourage people that are the descendants of people to participate in the activities at the fort. We have a very strong living history program. We have the archaeological activities that we do, and we have a volunteer program with the laboratory. You know, some people choose to volunteer at the fort, and others just like to come and visit and learn about where their ancestors worked and how they lived.
The last time I was here, you showed me the Hawaiian coral that was in the remember the name for it, but where they stored
powder magazine.
The powder magazine. There yeah. we go. So could you explain what you found there and why that is interesting?
Yeah, our excavations last summer were at a place called the Powder Magazine, which was the only brick structure inside the Fort Stockade. And what's the interesting connection with Hawaii, with the Powder Magazine, is that the mortar for the bricks and for the foundation, the stone foundation of the building, were all made from ground-up coral from Hawaii. And it's very exciting. Just in the last week, we've had an expert in coral come down from Washington State University, Vancouver. And he's been looking at our coral and is going to give us some ideas on which particular island it came from and how it was mined and how it got over here. So we're very excited about that. But it's really amazing as an archaeologist to be out digging in the middle of the Pacific Northwest and you pull up a chunk of coral from Hawaii. It's really, really hammers home the fact that we have had a much greater connection with Hawaii in the past in the Pacific Northwest than perhaps we do now. Now we go to Hawaii as a matter of taking a vacation. Back then it was really part of the whole trading system.
And what else do you do here besides what else? Just tell me about what you do here.
Obviously, we have an excavation program that's geared to the different projects that the Historic Reserve is doing. For example, we excavated at the Powder Magazine, and we'll probably do a reconstruction of that building. We're also very interested in teaching, and we have a field school every year through Portland State University where we teach the methods of archaeology. And field schools are pretty typical for an archaeological program, but ours is fairly unique in that we have the students learn some of the techniques of interpretation. And because this is a national park, we have the students interpret what they're doing to the visiting public, which can be very terrifying for students. Most archaeologists get into archaeology because they figure all the people they're going to have to deal with are dead. But here we actually interact with the visiting public. And there's a lot of interest on the public on what archaeologists do, and a lot of misconceptions out there that we can change. You know, for example, we don't dig dinosaurs, we're digging up the historic past.
So, in this program, I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to sort of bring it to this is where people lived in a physical place that's still here. So, I mean, besides if it's not raining, which it hasn't started to do yet, you know, I'd like you to go outside and say, this is where it was, look over there, sort of thing. But also, think, well, here's your chance to get people to come to Fort Vancouver to see it. So, in the context of Kanaka Village, exciting pitch. Come see Fort Vancouver. Why is it so important in the history of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest and the history of the Pacific Northwest?
The village area in Fort Vancouver was really critically important to the history of the Pacific Northwest. And the multicultural village with all the different groups of people that lived there was really quite unique. And certainly from a Native Hawaiian perspective, it's really kind of a mecca of you know, places where the first Hawaiians came to the Pacific Northwest out of Hawaii. And so it's really part of that whole process of people kind of expanding their horizons as part of the, you know, global change that was going on in the mid-19th century. And certainly for Hawaiians, it's a signature of a very dramatic change in Hawaiian history, and as well as a dramatic change in the history of the Pacific Northwest here at Fort Vancouver. We're going to talk about the land bridge.
Sure. If you could say something else about the conflict between Britain and America, maybe having to do with Astoria, perhaps, how it was. Remember you were saying before about how Astoria, like they, someone was going to try to come over and take it over, but they'd already ceded. And I mean, was it less stressful since it was the West Coast than from the East Coast, the conflict?
No, not really. The early in the history, before Hudson's Bay Company got here, some of the first fur traders out here were actually Americans, and the John Jacob Astor came out with the a expedition that came both overland and by sea, and they established Astoria in Oregon, out at the mouth of the Columbia River. And right about that time, 1811, right as they were getting it established, the War of 1812 broke out, and there was actually a British schooner that was on its way to take over the fort. And before they did that, the Astorians sold out to the Northwest Company, which was another British company that had just started working in the Pacific Northwest. So this was really on the kind of the ends of the world for Europeans and East Coast Americans. And so that's kind of how the British really got a strong foothold in the Pacific Northwest. By 1821, the Northwest Company and Hudson's Bay Company merged together, and as a consequence of that, a few years later, 4 years later, they decided to move their main base here in the Pacific Northwest up the river to Fort Vancouver.
Can you just give me a sentence, that the years that Fort Vancouver was in operation?
Fort Vancouver was established in 1825. They moved down to the present fort site, where we have the National Park, in 1829, and then it really stayed here through 1860.
And do you know how many Hawaiians worked for the company, maybe at the peak?
There were That's a good question. I'd have to look that up. I'll make a swag. There were probably around 100 Hawaiians working for the company, kind of at the peak.
Is there any way of telling what they thought about their jobs, or is there much about them at all?
Unfortunately for most of the people living in the village, including the native Hawaiians, we really don't know much about what they thought. Most of them were illiterate. They didn't write down their feelings or their thoughts about, you know, their bosses or, you know, their neighbors or things of that sort. So in essence, we really have to rely on the archaeological record to kind of fill out the story of the people that lived in the village. And it's really through those tangible things that they left behind, their tools, their beads, parts of clothing, the sorts of foods that they were eating, that we can really learn about who those people were.
And do you have much of a story yet, or do you think maybe in the next few years you'll...
In the next few years, we've already got quite a story already with, you know, from some of the previous work, but certainly in the next few years, we've got a couple of doctoral dissertations that are being worked on, and really should have a much clearer view of what the village was like, and hopefully we'll have some reconstructions and some interpretive elements out in the village for people to really take a look at. So as part of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, one of the things that they're putting in is the Confluence Project, which are a number of art pieces all along the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon. And we've got one of those Confluence pieces here, which is actually going to be one of the larger ones. It's a land bridge, which is going to go from the village and cross the highway into Old Apple Tree Park, which is also part of the village. The Old Apple Tree is perhaps the oldest apple tree in the Pacific Northwest. It was planted in about 1826. And this land bridge is going to really celebrate what was here in the Portland-Vancouver Basin before Lewis and Clark got here at contact. And should be an amazing piece. They're going to make it in the shape of a Klickitat basket, and we'll have a number of features that really tell the story of the Native American story here.
So where's it going to go?
It'll be right from the southern portion of the village on Park Service property, cross the highway, and then land in Old Apple Tree Park, and from there you can get out to the waterfront. So it's really going to reconnect the water with the village.
Can you think of anything else that you would like to say?
Come to Fort Vancouver.
Can you give me just one more? I am, and your name and what you do, just in case there was something in the beginning.
My name is Doug Wilson. I'm an archaeologist at the Vancouver National Historic Reserve, and I'm an associate professor at Portland State University.
What do you teach?
Archaeology.
Sounds good. It was originally only supposed to be 10 minutes, and it's now grown to 15 because I have so much information.
So we go up to the trees and hope we're getting far away from them.
Didn't mess anything up. All right, so describe where we are and the layout.
So we're in the heart of...
just a second.
Change the levels
okay,
a little
yeah.
bit.
Loud. Okay, go ahead.
We're in the heart of the village. We're kind of on the eastern edge. We've just walked up a north-south road, and there's actually a fence line that we've reconstructed on the east side that was kind of the boundary of the village. And you can actually see the fort site from here. I love to bring people out here because this is the way people would have usually seen Fort Vancouver, would have been from the village, not from the parking lot and the pathway that they normally come into the stockade. There would have been quite a few houses out here, probably 40 or 50, maybe upwards to 60 structures out here at any one time. And we're actually just to the north of a major east-west road. So, and you can see there's a couple of kind of
borders that we've set up that are the locations of some of the house sites that have been excavated archaeologically. So we've got a couple of those delineated in approximately their correct size. And you can really see how small some of the houses were, and that they were living very differently from the way people were living inside the fort itself.
So what do we have? So do you know if there was a layout, like if there were three roads, or if there was a place where they all would congregate, or?
Well, we know that there was a major east-west road that really cut the village in half. And then there was this north-south road right on the eastern side of the village. And we do have a couple of maps that show this. And the north-south road went all the way up to what's Fifth Street now, which is a what they used to call Upper Mill Road, which is a historic road. And right on the north side of that was the Catholic Mission. And then just down to the south of us was a major westward trailing road, which was called Lower Mill Road, which went into the main gate of Fort Vancouver. So we had, you know, one road that was going up to church and one road that was going to work. Typical. There were was a pond just to the south of us that was kind of a defining geographic feature. And there were quite a few industrial buildings around that. There was a hospital there. And then there were probably some gardens and some places where they kept animals here in the middle of the village too. So the houses were kind of spread out, and everybody kind of set up their own space. They were responsible for building their houses on their own, although the company provided some mill ends for them to work with. So, but it was kind of after work, you'd take some time off and build your house sort of thing.
Okay, anything else you want to say about the physical layout, or?
There must be something I want to say, but like I can just point out some of the houses that we were excavating.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, and just some of these houses directly to the south of us were excavated in the 1960s, and then we revisited them just in the last few years. And then directly to the north of us, we found a house site that was not shown on any of the maps, and really came up with some spectacular finds. Some very interesting pottery, a camp knife, lots of bone debris from and we actually found the hearth site where they had been doing their cooking. Really an amazing house site.
Okay.
Mowing my lawn.
So this actually wasn't a floodplain like they thought?
It's a floodplain, but it never really flooded up here.
So what might make you think that there's some education in the village?
We're looking at some slates that were excavated from some of the village sites, and one of them has incised lines and ABC scratched into it. So suggests that at least for some of the villagers, there was some education going on. And we know from the historical record that some of the village children were being taught by members of the kind of the gentleman class at Fort Vancouver. And actually by 1845, there were a pair of schoolhouses that had been constructed.